You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Heartland Politics Show and Podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. I'm your host, Robin Johnson, and Labor Day weekend traditionally marked the start of the fall campaigns, and here we are, although in some ways it feels like campaigns never end. But this is the start, and we're recording this the day of the presidential debate, but here to unpack all the latest on the 2024 election, a very important election, is Jacob Rubashkin, who works with Inside Elections. And I remember us talking 2 years ago about this same time, because you're one of the best out there in analyzing elections. And I'm really glad to have you back on the show today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, well, of course, we've got it's been a really unbelievable year for all of us political junkies. So many ups and downs, unanticipated events. But here we are, Donald Trump and Kamala Harris.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought? Yeah, exactly. Where does it stand right now here? It is September 10th, 2024. Where does it stand overall? And then we'll get down into the weeds a little bit here in a bit.
Yeah, the bottom line is this is a really close and competitive presidential election, which is, if you zoom way out, kind of what we expected heading into this election cycle. And obviously, the twists and turns of the Republican primary and Joe Biden and the debate and everything that's happened over the last 7 or 8 months have changed that picture. But ultimately, what we expected heading into this 2024 election season was a close competitive race between the Democratic nominee, whoever that was, and the Republican nominee, whoever that was. And that is what we're getting. We have had a lot of events take place over the last 7 weeks, and yet the state of the race nationally is a narrow lead for Kamala Harris, and the state of the race in the 7 crucial swing states that will determine the Electoral College is pure toss-up. And so, you know, with 7 weeks left to go in this election, obviously we've got the debate tonight. We've got, I don't know, $1 billion, $2 billion, give or take, dollars in advertising spending that's going to be unleashed on the American people over the next couple of weeks. So there's still potential for things to move around. But at the moment, we are looking at a very close race between Vice President Harris and former President Trump.
What's amazing to me, and I've seen some data on it, and I know you've seen it, is that throughout the year, Donald Trump's numbers in the general election have hardly moved through the awful assassination attempt, through the debate with Biden, which moved Biden's numbers. Now Kamala Harris is his opponent. It seems like that number is just stuck there. I mean, does that have the potential still to move much, or are you betting that it's going to wind up right around there come election day?
Look, I think that undecided voters ultimately have to make up their minds, and there are still a few undecided voters out there for the candidates to fight over. But you're absolutely right that Trump's number has pretty much stayed static at around 43% or 44% for the duration of the election cycle. And all of the differentiation has been on the Democratic side. When Biden was ahead back at the beginning of the year, it was because he was running stronger. When Biden dropped down over the summer, even before the debate, but certainly after the debate, it was because he had lost steam among Democratic constituencies. And when Harris popped out to a sizable lead when she became the nominee, it was because she had recaptured support from all those Democratic voters. She was not flipping very many, if any, voters from Trump into her column. So a remarkably static number for Trump. You know, we saw something similar in the 2020 presidential election. where if you looked at the polling averages, it was like two train tracks for most of the time. And if you go all the way back to 2016, Trump also got, you know, a roughly equivalent amount of the vote. He got 46.1% in 2016, 46.8% in 2020. So fairly little deviation compared to the Democrats, who went from Hillary Clinton at 48% to Joe Biden at 51%. So I would anticipate that, yeah, Trump is going to get what he's going to get. And Kamala Harris will win or lose based on how well she can consolidate the non-Trump vote nationally and across these swing states, from third-party voters, yes, so your RFK Jr. supporters, your Jill Stein, Chase Oliver, Cornel West, but also just from people who are deciding, you know, to vote for Harris or to stay on the couch. That is just as crucial for her, perhaps even more crucial, because those are gettable voters. A voter who is going to vote for RFK or Jill Stein probably not going to turn around and say, actually, I like the Democratic Party now. That's not how a lot of those voters think. So absolutely, I think that this race is going to be won or lost based on Kamala Harris's vote share more so than Donald Trump's.
One question I have for you that I've been doing a lot of look at data, especially in rural counties, which is kind of my specialty, in advance of a class I'll be teaching on rural politics next spring, but also for this show and in preparation for guests like you. But what I've noticed is that turnout just exploded in 2020. And a lot of that turnout, it was on both sides, but more of it went to Trump than Biden. It was up quite a bit from 2016. I think a key question is, will that turnout still be at 2020 levels, which could help Trump? Or do you think the excitement's down a little bit and turnout overall might be down a little bit? And who might that help either way?
I would anticipate that turnout will be lower than it was in 2020. I don't think that it will be as low as it was in 2016, which was an abnormally low year. But 2020 set, I believe, the high watermark for turnout for the last 100 years. And if you go back that far, of course, you're not dealing with elections where everyone could actually vote. So for realistic purposes, 2020 had the highest overall participation, I would argue, of any election in American history, at least on the presidential level. The reason for that was twofold, of course. The first is political. The second is practical. The political reason: Trump was a massive draw into politics for voters of all stripes. He really got people involved, no matter what their station or political belief, the way that his administration functioned, how all-encompassing it was, how inescapable it was. Even if you had not been involved in or paying attention to politics before Trump, he drew you in either positively or negatively. Layer on top of that, the COVID-19 pandemic, which was, in my view, the clearest articulation of the role that government plays in every single person's life on a daily basis. Americans saw firsthand constantly their political leaders and the decisions they were making in a way that, generally speaking, people can go days, months, years without really thinking about who's in charge. COVID-19 made that impossible. Everyone understood very much what was going on in the government. And layer on top of that, the George Floyd protests, right? You had the largest social movement in America, arguably since the 1960s and 70s. And that also drew more and more people into the political process. So you had a lot of political factors that were pushing people to vote. And on top of that, because of the pandemic, states all across the country, red states, purple states, blue states, made it easier to vote than ever before. We had a number of states transition entirely to all-mail ballots. States increased the opportunity to vote early, drop boxes, all manner of methods of voting, given the ongoing pandemic, that made it easier for a lot of people to cast a ballot. And so when you had those two factors combining, you got a historic election. this cycle, I think some of the states that had previously rapidly expanded access to the ballot have since cut back. Part of that was because the measures during COVID were emergency measures that didn't stay in force. Part of that, I think, is a political reaction to Trump's lies about the election being stolen via mail-in balloting and early voting. I think Republicans in some states have taken those conspiracy theories to heart and restricted access accordingly. You know, some states have increased access. I mean, California is the most notable one. California went to all mail in 2020. They mailed every single voter a ballot, and they have remained as such since then. But it's not as expansive as it was in 2020 nationwide. And then the other thing is just that with Trump not necessarily kind of front and center every single day, I just think that there's less. His fans are less motivated. His opponents are less motivated because he's no longer president anymore. So that's a very long way of saying, no, I don't think turnout will be as high as in 2020, but I think it still will be on the higher end of things. I think the post-Dobbs landscape has demonstrated that certainly Democrats are willing to show up for elections, even in more conservative territory. The enthusiasm that we've seen since Harris became the nominee also suggests to me that Democrats are very fired up to go out and vote. So I would anticipate higher than normal turnout, but not reaching the degree of 2020.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is Jacob Bravashkin, who's one of the top analysts of elections in the country. He's with Inside Elections, and I highly recommend you follow him, his writing, and on social media as well, on X, Twitter. We're giving you an election preview here. We're about a couple months out, and Jacob's talking a little bit about the presidential race. I guess, you know, we're, and I'm segueing in on the last answer you gave, but we elect our presidents to the Electoral College, not the popular vote, as everybody knows. I remember back in the early 2000s, there used to be like 18 battleground states. And now there's, as you said, seven. Okay. And most people have decided, most people I talk to are not undecided at all. They know who they're going to vote for, but there's a narrow swath out there in these seven states that will decide this thing. Who are they generally? I mean, demographically, who might they be? Who might they resemble? And what issues might pull them one way or the other?
This is a great question, and your point is well taken on the number of battleground states. It's a bit longer scope, but a stat that I heard recently that I thought was just incredible was in the election of 1976, where Jimmy Carter defeated Gerald Ford, there were 22 states where the margin of victory was under 5% in the presidential election, which is incredible. Because back then, that really meant that you had to run a nationwide campaign. You didn't just run in the swing states like we do now. You really did have to run everywhere, because everywhere was liable to vote for your opponent if you didn't campaign actively for their votes. And that's just not the way that we do things anymore. The campaigns are laser focused on these seven states: Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Nevada, Arizona, North Carolina. Now, who are the voters in these states that matter? It's two populations, especially when looking at the Harris campaign, right? I think the thing that unifies them is a relative lack of interest in politics. If you are more interested in politics, you're more likely to have already made your mind up. You're more likely to be partisan and have self-sorted into one camp or the other. But a lot of people, most people even, are not thinking about this kind of thing every day. They're less politically engaged, and they are more up for grabs. It is voters who have been at the center of a lot of the large political shifts that we've seen over the last 10 years. So voters in the suburbs, particularly white voters with college degrees, particularly women in the suburbs with college degrees, these are the white women, I'll be specific here, these are the battleground voters in a lot of these states. You look at the what connects the seven states that I mentioned. It's the suburbs of Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. It's the suburbs of Milwaukee. It's the and Chicago. It's the Detroit suburbs and the East Lansing suburbs and the suburbs of Kalamazoo out in western Michigan. It's the suburbs around Atlanta. It's Maricopa County and the suburbs around Phoenix. And it is, you know, Nevada's probably of itself because the state is just so different demographically. But in North Carolina, it's the suburbs around Raleigh-Durham and Charlotte. It really, this is the through line here of the Democratic, the new Democratic coalition, as all of those states have seen the white non-college educated voters that once were the bedrock of the party fall off and move toward the Republicans. There's been a corresponding shift among a different set of voters. So that's one important group. The other important group, again, is the voters that are picking between Harris and staying at home. And these are younger voters, voters of color, young voters of color, who are also integral to the coalition in all of these states. And this is really where Biden was truly failing toward the end of his campaign. It wasn't just that he was failing to win over independents, moderates, swing voters. He was also failing to maintain the integrity of the underlying Democratic coalition. He was not able to motivate a lot of voters who tend to historically vote Democratic in significant numbers. Now, presidential elections, you have to do both. You can't just do base motivation or persuasion. You have to do both. But Biden wasn't doing either. And that's ultimately what pushed him out of the race. For Harris, you know, she's going to need strong youth turnout, and she really needs to get back to the margins among Black voters that Biden put up, which was about an 80-point margin. Margins are about among Hispanic voters that Biden put up, which may be, you know, a 30-point, 40-point margin at best. She's not hitting either of those marks yet. That's going to be determinative in a state like Nevada or Arizona with significant Hispanic populations, or states like the blue wall states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and the Sun Belt states, North Carolina and Georgia, both of which have significant Black populations and which have pockets that are driving Democratic turnout and support centered on college towns like Michigan State, University of Michigan, you know, places like that, that, you know, University of Wisconsin-Madison, that really turned out for Democrats in 2022 and need to turn out for Democrats again if Harris is going to win.
Interesting. I guess I can look at this, and all the polls are showing this really, really close nationwide, and the state polls are close as well. But it almost seems like if voters go fill up with gas or go to the grocery store before they go to the polls, that might remind them of inflation, which could hurt Harris. But, there's some solid evidence out there that ever since Trump's election, ever since 16, the Democrats have overperformed because of the abortion issue in referendums and in 18 and 20, 22 elections. So it just seems like those issues are playing out in these battleground states. And it's really going to be interesting to see who really gets motivated to turn out in the end.
Voters are complex. Voters juggle a lot of different factors when making their electoral decisions, especially those swing voters who are liable to vote one way or the other. Ultimately, 45% of people are going to vote one way and 45% are going to vote the other. And we're talking about a 10% of the population spread out across these states that is determinative. But I think that voters are making a very complex calculation when they decide who to cast their ballot for. And like you said, the inflation issue, absolutely an albatross around Democrats' necks. But it's not the only thing that voters are thinking about. They're also thinking about the economy in other regards, unemployment. They're thinking about abortion. They're thinking about democracy. They're thinking about the border, education. People are pretty multifaceted. The thing that Harris has been able to do, which I have found striking, and I don't think anyone would have expected 7 weeks ago when she took on the Democratic nomination, was create real distance between herself and the unpopular elements of the Biden administration, of which she is a very big part. She's the sitting vice president. And yet, on the Biden administration's worst issues, the economy and cost of living and the border and immigration, voters give her a greater benefit of the doubt against Trump than they ever gave Joe Biden, simply because she's not Joe Biden. She's someone different. She's new. She's exciting. And a lot of the policy perception, I think, actually is downstream of the personal perception. I think voters decided they didn't like Biden and they didn't think that he was up for the job. And that filtered down to their views of him on any number of policy issues. With Harris, they don't really know her that well yet, but they like what they see. And so they're more willing to align with her on the exact same policy questions that they were not happy with Joe Biden on. And so I think that it's been striking to see her image rating shoot upwards from very poor to better than Donald Trump by a significant amount nationwide. And I think that's a big reason of why she's jumped out to a larger lead than Biden ever had, and why she's very much reset this race.
Here in Illinois and Iowa, where we're located in Quad Cities, Iowa used to be a purple state, a swing state. It's moved more red. Illinois is a solid blue state. We don't have any U.S. Senate races in either state this year. But we do have a couple hot House races. And I remember 2 years ago, specifically, I put it in the headline of my playing the interview online and sharing it, was that the two House races could determine control of the House. And I had people say, oh, come on, and I was a little skeptical myself. They really did. Is it the case that those two races could determine the House again this time?
Yes and no. So we're talking about here Illinois' 17th district, which is currently represented by Democrat Eric Sorensen, and Iowa's 1st district, represented by Republican Marionette Miller Meeks. Last cycle, the 17th was a toss-up race, one of the most competitive in the country, a lot of money flowing into it from outside groups, and Iowa's 1st was competitive, but less so. Not as much of a priority for either major party. And the results bore that out. Eric Sorensen won his election by a fairly narrow margin, and Marionette Miller Meeks won her election by double the margin in Iowa's 1st. The roles are pretty clearly reversed this time around. I got to tell you, I talk to a lot of party strategists every day, and I hear next to nothing about the 17th congressional district. It is generally considered to be at best at the edge of the battlefield for Republicans, especially after the switch at the top of the Democratic ticket. There was some excitement earlier in the year about the Republican nominee in that race, Joe McGraw. He's a former judge. He brings a law enforcement background to the race that Republicans always like to get behind, but he has not really been able to get anything going there. I mean, he's struggled in fundraising, and the district, as it's redrawn, and you know this better than most people, the Illinois state legislature did a very good job of gerrymandering the congressional map after the 2020 census. It just doesn't look like it's ripe for Republicans to pick off this cycle. Conversely, Iowa's 1st district is the talk of the town. Really, just in the last 2 weeks or so, Democrats have gotten incredibly excited about this rematch between Miller Meeks and Christina Bohannon, the former state representative who lost by about 8 points last cycle. The main Democratic House Super PAC, House Majority PAC, just launched a $2 million investment in this race this past week. That's a clear sign that they are taking it very seriously. And I can tell you, I think that this race is pretty close to tied right now between Miller Meeks and Bohannon. If Democrats can pick off a seat like Iowa's 1st, it helps them not only mitigate losses that they might take elsewhere, but expand their paths to the majority beyond just the kind of the typical New York and California map that we love to talk about, where, you know, Democrats are need to flip Biden seats or blue seats in New York and California and some other blue states. If they can start picking off a few Trump seats here and there across the Midwest, that opens up a tremendous possibility for the party to take back the majority.
So it could play a role in if it's really close. It could help determine, or are you prepared to say that, or you want to be a little more cautious?
Look, I don't think that it's there yet. I still think that there are better opportunities for Democrats elsewhere, and that it's very possible for me to see a universe in which Democrats take back the House without Iowa's first. But I think that certainly if on election night we're looking at that race and it is headed in Bohannon's direction, that's a great sign for Democrats.
I've got about just 60 seconds left. I guess I'm not going to put you on the spot and ask who wins. I mean, there's too much going on. But one peculiarity we have in our Electoral College system are there are two states that do not have winner-take-all. They apportion it by congressional districts. And one is fairly close to here, Nebraska, on the Iowa border. Real quick, those could come into play too, because the Electoral College could be 269 to 269. I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, but how are those two districts leaning right now, if you could, Jacob, in about 45 seconds?
So the two districts that we're watching most closely are Maine's 2nd Congressional District, which is all of northern Maine. We currently see Trump favored there. He won it in 2016. He won it in 2020. He'll probably win it again in 2024. It'll be close, maybe single digits. It'll probably reelect its Democratic congressman at the same time. But we see Trump favored in that electoral vote. Different picture in Omaha, Nebraska's 2nd congressional district. This is a seat that voted for Biden in 2020. I think Kamala Harris is pretty clearly favored there, again, by just a couple of points. But that should be very helpful to her. And there are some scenarios in which that electoral vote, if she can hold it, will help her avoid that 269-269 tie, get her to a 270-268 result, and ensure she's elected the next president. So I would expect a significant amount of investment from the Harris campaign in that blue dot, as Obama once called it, in Nebraska's 2nd district.
Jacob Rabashkin's been my guest today on Heartland Politics. It's fascinating as always. Jacob is deputy editor of Inside Elections. Here's his Twitter feed. You should follow it. It's at Jacob Rabashkin, Rubashkin. That's all one word. This is a nonpartisan site. So everybody is welcome to look at it. Jacob, thank you so much for taking the time again. Very fascinating. The time flew by as always.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a presentation of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR. You can follow Heartland Politics at WVIK.org or wherever you subscribe to podcasts.